Hey, Printavos, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Bruce from Printavo. Super excited to have another episode. We've got Mr. Stephen Farag out of Campus Inc. We got a super awesome guest today, Henry Ma, CEO of Racoma. Racoma Mix Embroidery Machines are down in Florida. They've got this really cool like conference they do every year called Deco Summit that we'll join or go visit and help and talk at and things. But anyway, we'll get into the episode. But very quickly, we got a couple of awesome sponsors.
Do you need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department? If you go to 1900hotstuff.com, you'll find an awesome website where Lucas and Nick Wood are, because they work for Graphic Source, and Graphic Source offers industry-leading options for your shop, and they're truly a part of your team. They plug and play with Printavo and other shop management softwares, and when it comes to SEPs, mockups, creative art, order management, embroidery digitizing, back office admin, and customer service, there's no better company in our industry to work with. Hit them up at graphicsource.com for art staffing needs and mention the Printavo podcast for 50% off your first vector, SEP, or embroidery order. Thanks, Graphic Source.
All right, next up we got Easy Way. You shouldn't spend all day cleaning dirty screens. Easy Way's line of environmentally conscious chemicals will get the job done faster, more efficiently, and cost you a fraction of the cost per screen.
Thanks, Easy Way. Bruce, have you heard of Multicraft underscore daddy?
Who dat?
If you need ink supplies or a daddy, Multicraft Screen Printing and Digital Supplies for over 50 years has been providing you with top brands at competitive prices. Mention the Printavo podcast and receive an extra 10% off your first order. Hit up Dave Eggers and the Multicraft team. Thanks, Multicraft.
Sweet. Last but not least, Supacolor. Mr. Steven, what do you use Supacolor for in your shop?
Supacolor is the world's best heat transfer. Made by screen printers for screen printers, Supacolor understands firsthand the pressures and expectations of the screen printing business. That's why they pride themselves on being super fast and super easy. We use Supacolor in our shop. They know how to hit color gamuts. They know how to ship anywhere in the country really, really fast. And you can experience them for yourself using promo code PRINTAVO15 to get 15% off your order. Thanks, Supacolor.
Just texting Rum. He pressed Jesus because Chris said my wife's working on the scrubs, as you know, and then she's getting to the point of labeling and, like like how Lululemon or Vori or one of those has like the cool little, like heat press kind of thicker, but on some sort of specialty athletic fabric. So he's super nice. He was like, dude, come on in. Like, we'll test it on different fabrics, see what sticks. You know, you can wash it and play around with it and stuff. So I was like, oh, that's awesome.
That's exciting. Their facility is insane. So thanks to our sponsors. We're going to have a fun show today.
Mr. Henry Ma, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you for having me.
This is Stephen, by the way, Stephen Farag. You haven't met him before. By the way, your backdrop is sweet.
Yeah, it's like a brick veneer sort of thing.
Yeah, with the lighting and everything.
Do you have backlight?
Yeah. We have like a little light here.
This is a studio.
Yeah. We kind of built out a small studio. We're outgrowing it though. It's like, you don't see it behind the scenes, but I'm like up against a machine, a table. It's pretty packed in here with lights and everything.
Yeah, we need to step our game up, Farag. So normally I actually, Henry, go into, I'll start at the beginning and I kind of want to tell a story, but I actually want to switch it up this time and sort of jump in at the present, and then we'll figure it out from there.
Okay.
So, based on some research on LinkedIn, you've got about 66 employees on LinkedIn. Tell me, actually, for each bullet point, tell me if this is right or wrong. There's 66 people on LinkedIn. Is that right? I mean, at least for the headquarters aspect.
No, we're actually at about like 120. In headquarters.
Okay. So people are not updating their LinkedIn.
Yeah. And another like 15 in California, actually. So about 130.
Oh, really?
Yeah. 135 around there.
That's cool. Where in California?
Rancho. So more east of LA, Rancho Cucamonga, about like an hour from LA.
Okay. That's super cool. So, all right. 100 plus, 150, you know, team members. Google says 10 to 50 million in revenue.
We're on track for about close to 100. We're probably on track to 100 million this year.
Okay. Bruce, where are you getting your information?
All right, look, everything is clearly underrepresented.
for good reason, I guess. But no, we hit about 70 million last year, and wow. We're on track for about 100. So we've been running at about a 45 to 50% growth clip for the last like 2 to 3 years consistently. I don't know how long that'll last, but
was that a blow up from COVID where people started switching hobbies and picking things up? And,
yeah, for sure.
Or is that just consistent?
I think the COVID definitely helped in the sense where people were needing like equipment to build their business from home and stuff. So that definitely had a spike, but then I think what we've been seeing on the fortunate side is that hasn't dipped since then, which is good. So, but it definitely, I think it propelled the industry to like a whole new level. And then after that, it's just kind of like who can sustain that level of market share, right? But we definitely saw that the entire market size and the pie grew also, like just more people got into the business. And then I guess like that kind of people saw how people were able to sustain like a second source of income and revenue from that. And I guess like they just kept on wanting to make sure that they have that safety net.
Yeah, it is. My wife now has from COVID 2 heat presses. press and a large one. Thank you, heatpressnation.com. But you know, I'm kind of curious. So with the scale, how do you spend your day? I think we all juggle way too many things. And I'm sure, you know, you may be in that bucket too, but at the same time, there must be some sort, like you can't keep doing the same thing that I'm sure you know, at 10 million now closer to 100, right? So
yeah,
what do you spend your day thinking about?
Sure. So it's funny you mentioned that because I've definitely seen a transition from that 10 million range to where we're at now in terms of my day to day. I mean, I remember back in the day, I used to like, you know, answer phone calls and talk to customers, answer tickets and support requests, go to like drive alongs with technicians to visit our customers, like all that. It's, you know, I wish I still had time to do all that. But I think we've built a great team in place to be able to handle a lot of the day to day. And my role now is really focusing on, I think, like, probably over 70% of my time is focused on recruiting and retaining talent. That's really like the biggest part, like just dealing with people, you know, like it's at the end of the day, like a people business. So a lot of my time is spent on like recruiting, retention, following up with our team on those aspects. And then the other, I guess, 20-30% is really on just overall like strategy on what other things we want to get into and hopefully be able to expand into those areas. I mean, I'm sure you guys have seen as well that over the years we've gradually expanded beyond just manufacturing of embroidery machines. We're now selling a lot of other stuff like DTG printers and white toner transfer printers, heat presses. All of that is to kind of expand our reach and our I guess umbrella of services that we're able to offer.
I was just stalking your LinkedIn a little bit. You went to NYU for business school, and then you were at Goldman Sachs as an investment banker, working on IPOs. Like, were you working in M&A? How did you fall into like investment banking into the decoration space? How did that all happen?
Yeah. So it's like complete. Other ends of the opposite ends of the spectrum. It's like completely not related. I think when I came out of NYU, I mean, I kind of was around a lot of people that was all, you know, all day talking about finance. It was also something that I wanted to try growing up. I saw all these things in the Wall Street Journal and people like doing like multi-billion dollar deals. And so it just seemed it seemed interesting to be able to have that experience. So after graduation, that's where I kind of joined. you know, it was a great time and a great experience to be in investment banking. But then afterwards, I just felt I wasn't fulfilled enough in kind of building a product and building a team. And so after that, I kind of, joined. I essentially grew up around the business. It's a family owned business. So I kind of grew up around it. And then I came back and I said, you know, my father asked me, it's like, hey, is it worthwhile for you to kind of, you know, take a look and see what you can add, you know, if you can add value to the business. And I told them that I'll take a look for a couple of months and see if it's something interesting that I want to take on. And if so, I'll be happy to kind of, you know, add value and grow it further. And as they say, the rest is history. So I kind of saw a great opportunity to build a product, build a team, and then expand the foundation of the business even further. And we've been able to grow so much since the early 2010s. So it's been a great ride.
Did your family own it, or did your dad just play a large stake in it? Tell us like a little bit more about that. I'm curious, because like I watched my dad own a business and it kind of helped me want to get into business and stuff like that. I think that's really interesting. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So we do own the business 100%. He started in the business more on the sewing machine side. So that's how he kind of got started. And so we were selling sewing machines to South America a lot. But then just found like the margins were really tight, and the margins were being squeezed, and then the distributors would kind of skip over you if you're just a dealer or a master distributor. They would just skip over you and just go directly to the source, which is a factory. And then that kind of spawned this idea that okay, we need to find a product that's higher margin and that we have control over the entire process, so nobody can just skip over you and go directly to the source and therefore get it that way. So that ended up to be our bread and butter, which is in embroidery machines. And then at first we started just redistributing other people's products, but then kind of found that because of the quality, because of the lack of control, we really needed to make our own product. And that's when we kind of built our whole manufacturing facility and a whole team overseas to be able to manufacture our own product, and now do the R&D, the design and manufacturing, all the way to the sales and support. So we kind of control the entire process from end to end.
So you've fully verticalized like everything from manufacturing to sales. I mean, you could buy it direct online, everything.
Exactly. So we really found that the core competitive advantage is in the R&D, right? Like if you don't control the product, you can sell it, which is great, but then at the end of the day, you can't innovate fast enough. You can't get the feedback fast enough to be able to, iterate your product. And as I'm sure you guys know, in product development, it takes time. It takes a lot of resources and effort. And so having control over the R&D and the design was important to us. And we found that like long run, that had to be the way out. So it wasn't sustainable just to sell someone else's product.
Specifically, like we run a shop and we run embroidery machines. I won't say what brand it is, but I've noticed the technology hasn't changed that much. Like, is that a core of your business, is like making it, like modernizing it? Because when I go to the trade shows and I see some of these machines, I'm like, wait a second, that's like the same computer system from 2010. How can that be?
Right.
Do you just feel like the industry is so old school that you're like, what are we doing here? This is it's 2022, right?
Yeah.
Or like, do you feel like there's an unfair... Do you feel like there's an unfair advantage to you guys because you're just taking, and I use this because you went to B school, you were at Goldman, you've seen this happen in very like competitive markets. Mm-hmm. Does it seem like easy because our industry's so old school? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
I think it goes both ways, right? Like it's easy in a sense where if everyone else is just kind of stuck in the old mindset, I mean, like you have clearly the upper hand if you're able to innovate, right? If everyone else is staying stagnant, it's hard in the sense of, because this is kind of like the norm that has been built in the industry over all these years, over decades and over the entire span of the history of the industry, a lot of the mindset and the mentality of the people in the industry is still kind of stuck in the same manner. And the customer's mindset are also stuck in the same manner. So, it's difficult in the sense where you have to kind of educate the market and you have to kind of drive change by it's a slower process because people are kind of entrenched or the incumbents are entrenched and have a specific way of thinking. And therefore that has affected all the customers over decades and decades of being in that industry. So it's difficult in that sense because you have to educate the market and that and educating any market takes a lot of work and takes a lot of time and is a very slow process. It's good in the sense where if everyone else is still kind of stuck in that old mindset, if you just keep at it and you are kind of innovating, whether it's in your product or in your approach, in your marketing, in your content, if you just kind of innovate constantly, it's eventually going to break through. The old kind of style of thinking is going to cycle out, and then you're kind of like the only thing that the market sees. So I think that's the good.
And I think the reason I say is like, I'm on the website, right? Rekoma.com. And I see like three big things, like second to none customer support, direct from the factory, highest quality and garment customization. But over and over again, you say 7 days a week, 5 years of warranty, zero hassle. I feel like our industry, these are things that, you know, Amazon does every day for us now, mm-hmm. but other companies, Bruce, mm-hmm. when we talk about other press manufacturers, like they're not doing these basic things that are so elementary. And then if you scroll down on the website, it even says like, it starts with the enthusiast to the startup to the commercial. So now you're walking your customer, kind of your customer journey all the way to by the time they're commercial. How much of that has been like you like pounding that mission down to your team, you know, from a leadership standpoint? Are you guys constantly focusing on that? Is that a big part of what you guys do?
Yeah, of course. And I think it starts with getting that mentality trickle down through everyone that, you know, day in and day out and every interaction they have with our customers, they keep those things in mind. The fact that we're able to offer, you know, 7 days a week and after hour support, the only one in the industry being able to do that, it sounds easy and obvious, right? That like, okay, yeah, you know, offering 7 day support, it's super helpful for the customer. They can call you on the weekends. It's a lot harder to execute. And so I think it's not that we're the first ones to have thought of that idea. You know, people have definitely done it, not just in our industry, maybe definitely in other industries, right? But it's a lot harder to execute. So when you have, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of customers to support, they can call you at any random time on the weekend, right? Obviously, we have a set time for our weekend and after hour schedule. But the fact that we're able to offer, you know, Monday through Friday support from like 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern time versus just the 9 to 5 that regular companies do. And the fact that on the weekends, you can still call from like 10 o'clock in the morning to like 5 p.m. in the afternoon. That is kind of a mission that we've set out and also had to overcome a lot of hurdles in executing that. You got to get the right people in place. You got to get the right processes in place. You got to have the right coverage. And a lot of that, you know, while it might seem very obvious and easy to do, it's a lot harder on the back end to execute. And, you know, part of that is just constantly hammering home the mission that we're on to provide the best service in the industry. But also, I think we look very carefully in hiring the right people that can fit into that culture and, you know, fully buy in to our mission of providing that support. And if you can't, if you don't buy into that culture, you know, they very quickly will find out that, you know, they're not going to be a good fit here.
How do you, what are the shifts for a team that works 7 days a week? Is it two in like Tuesday to Saturday?
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. So like they would still get two consecutive days of time off. It would just be if they're working on that Saturday, they might get like Sunday and Monday off. Or if they're working on Sunday, then they get Friday and Saturday off. So it will still get, you know, a full weekend. It would just kind of be staggered.
Yeah, that's super interesting. When we started, and I still emphasize this today, is just that really good support, as cliche as it sounds, is like a feature of the product. People think that it's a low hanging fruit, but just because everybody says, oh, great service, you know, 100% guarantee, blah, blah, blah. It's on every single person's website. But for someone to get an email back, you know, in 10 minutes or even pick up the phone. Sometimes it's shocking, like, cause you call, you know, another small business and you can't get somebody on the phone, but to provide that, people ride with you. You know that they like working with you. It's a part of your service. They could go buy stuff. They could go buy software from any other place, or home grow it or whatever they want. But that service aspect is pretty undervalued.
How do you measure the success of your service? Like, you can obviously measure the success of sales, but do you, you know, is it response time? Is it net performance? You know, and what is NPS or whatever? How, like, if I was a fly on the wall in your service center, what would that look like?
Yeah, it would be, response time is definitely part of it. You know, we don't want to keep customers waiting too long. And response time can fall into kind of, you know, the, how quickly you respond to the tickets that are coming in or emails that are coming in. And response time in terms of their wait time in the queue when they're calling in, right? You know, how long are they waiting in queue? Is it average time of 5 minutes, average time of 10 minutes? And then you establish a benchmark and you measure against that. And obviously, a very kind of high level metric, very, you know, obvious metric is going to be the satisfaction score. You know, if you're receiving 1,000 tickets on a monthly basis, how many of those end up in, good satisfaction, right? You know, and that's easy to measure just by sending out, you know, an automated kind of a quick 1 second survey that they can click a button and choose whether they were satisfied or not with the resolution. And those things, you know, you get feedback from that and you learn, and, you know, no team or company is perfect, but I think if you enjoy the process enough, you're going to, be immersed in trying to tinker and figure it out, right? I think that's the fun part that I wasn't able to do at Goldman. That's part of the reason why I left. Being able to kind of tinker and mess with the process and be more involved in kind of building that team and building that infrastructure and process to be able to see the results. The results at the end game isn't so much, you know, that great. You know, it's great that we achieved the goal, but then you kind of move on to the next one. And I think the fun is in the process of trying to figure it out.
Is that Zendesk? Is that the system you guys use?
Yeah.
It
is. Okay.
So, right, so like, Zendesk. Henry, do you run, like, do you use any systems or playbooks, whether it's like EOS, Traction, like OKRs, you know, like what is your operating system that you like live by? You know, like, I need these 10 metrics every week. Like, If I were to shadow you, because I probably need a lot of this help, no B school here, neither for Bruce. what is your playbook as a CEO? Because one of my best friends works at Morgan Stanley, and just watching them and how they operate and looking at the mergers and everything they're doing, I'm just like, whoa, like, this is next level stuff, mm-hmm. right? And then they go into PE or they go into the private sector and they just crush it as executives. You know, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest, you mentioned B school. Like, I think B school doesn't teach you much of these things. I think a lot of this is learned on the job and trying to figure it out. I think, I think what business school does is give you, and any education, it gives you a foundation and a way of thinking, right? It gives you a way of thinking. It doesn't really give you the tactical things that can be implemented to drive certain results. You might do like case studies and whatnot, but at the end of the day, every case is different. Every situation is different. You kind of have to, on the job, adjust and adapt to what's going on. So B school doesn't really show you a lot of that. I think a lot of this is really learned on the job. But in terms of the operating playbook that we go by, it's really dependent on, we have different metrics for different teams, right? We don't have like a standard tool or anything that measures a lot of KPIs or dashboards. We have some key metrics that we've set out for each team that will give you insight into the health of that team. As a simple example, you know, if for our fulfillment and logistics team, we want to be able to understand how quickly are we fulfilling the machines, right? If a customer's ordering on day one, like, are we fulfilling by day 7 or day 10, or how long does it take us to fulfill that order? And that obviously plays into customer satisfaction, because at the end of the day, the customer, we are promising, or the customer is expecting a certain level of turnaround time. And if you're not able to meet that, they obviously get upset and you get phone calls, et cetera, et cetera. So measuring kind of what our turnaround time is for machines is a key factor for that particular team. For a service team, it would be, you know, the number of tickets that they're solving, how fast they're resolving these issues, and also whether you know, what your kind of level of expense is for in warranty calls or service calls that you have to go to that you're covering, you know, all the parts and labor and everything like that. And that gives you an idea of your product quality, you know, how good is your quality control, and being able to spot trends as to, okay, why are we going on 10 service calls this month, let's say, for this one particular problem that seems to be a repeat problem. You might want to escalate that to engineering and get that taken care of, right? So it's just kind of setting out the right KPIs in place. I think you do need to probably look at metrics that's going to move the needle. I don't like to just look at vanity metrics of like, oh, we got, you know, 95% satisfaction this month. Like that's to me, it's like a vanity metric. It's very high level. It's also like just how much sales we got this month, how much revenue we got this month, right? Like that's a very high level metric, but you want to break down like what are the kind of building blocks for you to be able to reach that metric, that overall goal, and try to find ways to kind of navigate that individual metric to see if you can move the needle. I think in sales also, it's like our number of cross sells and upsells and our conversion ratio, right? And you break that down also by the reps that you have, and that gives you an idea of like who's outperforming, who's underperforming, and then you can make adjustments. It's less so about, hey, great, everyone, we did X million dollars of revenue this month, but then you're not really seeing the individual details of how it got you there and make adjustments to be able to increase that even further.
You know a ton clearly about the details here, and it sounds like you're pretty deep into the weeds, but like I think that's one of the things that we all struggle with, is trying to get out of the weeds, but also still being able to zoom in. I remember Bezos was like, yeah, you have to be able to, you know, zoom in quick, see the details, and then be able to go back up to 40,000 feet.
Yeah.
How do you balance those two? Is it some sort of like weekly, like Stephen mentioned the traction meeting, which teaches you're supposed to have the weekly meeting with your department heads. They show you the metrics of each team, and then you kind of problem solve what's wrong or how to improve. Yep. But how do you balance that? Because I'm sure there's also then, hey, Henry, something's wrong with the warehouse. The garage door's broke or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
You know, what should we do?
So, I mean, those things where it's like a small problem, yeah, like something wrong with the warehouse or we lost something or whatever the case is, I think that, you know, you got to get the right people in place to be able to handle that. So we have, you know, our operations manager, our VP of operations that will, and a warehouse manager that should be able to, you know, handle those type of issues. So that doesn't really, I don't really get a lot of calls or emails or messages about those type of issues. But to your point of like the weekly meetings, I think that is very necessary. And I do have a weekly meeting with all the department heads where they're all together, and they also learn from kind of what other departments are doing, what are the statuses of other departments. Each give like a 5-10 minute update as to what's going on, what are some initiatives they're doing in their team, what are some statuses, what are some key problems that need maybe cross department involvement. Maybe it's a shipping issue with some escalated customer that sales is dealing with, then shipping needs to be involved. Maybe it's a service issue, you know, with an escalated customer that wants, you know, some kind of refund or something. You know, you want to deal with that also. So it's just getting all the department heads together. You got to get the right team in place, and then they will take care of a lot of the nitty gritty details, in the weeds, solve probably like, you know, 90-95% of the problems that you will never, you know, really be aware of. And then the key metrics that you're looking at will kind of, you know, you should be able to spot, this looks off. Like, you know, I think I have a keen set, I guess, from the Goldman background. They really taught us to do a sanity check on all the numbers, because as an analyst, you're doing all these numbers, right? And then your associate or VP will be like, yeah, that looks wrong. And then they tell you, it's like, yeah, this is why I know from just glancing at it for 2 seconds that it's wrong, because they're doing like a very high level sanity check. It's like, I don't know what the right number is, but that just looks completely off. So I think I've been trained to do that for a lot of the numbers that I'm looking at. And when I get reported some number that doesn't make sense, then I start to question like, okay, how did you get that? And why is that the case? This sticks out like a sore thumb. Why have we looked into that? And then when we delve further because of that involvement, then you start finding problems. Like, oh yeah, we didn't realize that we had X number of losses from this product line that we didn't see, right? But it was that key metric that kind of brought it onto the radar and then started to have a discussion.
I want to talk a little bit about like education and your YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. You have over 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, and I just quickly searched for the other embroidery manufacturers, and like some didn't even have channels.
Yeah.
How important, you know, coming from iBanking and now talking YouTube and content, you're on a lot of these YouTube videos. How important is that to you? Did you have someone come in and say, Henry, this is what we got to do? Or is this kind of rooted in you as making a ton of content?
Cause it's, yeah, I think it was definitely no one came in and said like, this is what we need to do. But I saw, I think, you know, several years back, that we needed to do this because everyone in every other industry was doing this. Like if you were a plumber, like a plumber was on like, YouTube teaching people how to like fix their leak, right? Like, and then, you know, like that's, I just saw that. Yeah. I just saw that that was so much, that was so helpful because like after learning that, like, you know, if that guy was local, who am I going to go to when I need plumbing services? Like that person will be first on top of mind. Right. So I thought like this is education and content. It was something that's definitely super important. And also because people ask the same questions over and over again, like people ask like, OK, how do your machines, you know, what are the different models of machines you have? Like, what are the similarities and differences? And you have to explain the same answers over and over again. It's just like, might as well just put that into a video, right? put that into a video, the same questions that people ask, and put that into as content. And then we just found that our businesses kind of took off from that content. A lot of people were finding us just organically through these videos. And people that were on the fence thinking about kind of, okay, should I go with Ricoma for their particular machine? Our sales were able to use some of the videos we produce on YouTube to kind of educate the customer further. It's like, this is how you price your items. This is the difference between this machine and this machine. So I think it kind of spawned from just getting the same questions over and over and over again. And also from seeing other people in other industries and whether it's marketing services that like they were doing the same thing. So like, we found an opportunity that no one else was doing this to this level in our industry. I think it's a good good entrance for us to be able to educate the market and be on top of mind for everyone.
It's interesting. It makes you wonder if there's a lot of business opportunities separately for any company that isn't making regular content to be a manufacturer of. I mean, ink, screens, automated equipment, just. You're just like, wow, if somebody literally just dominated the content side of this, they could be the de facto solution. But so when you started, was there, or not started, but like when you joined with your dad, I read in this article that was the focus, was like, how do I help? I'm sure there's a ton of other things helping with too that you were doing, but also like a big one was, all right, how do I really grow this business so I can help on the marketing side? Let me start to dive in. So, you know, jump in. I'm sure there's like very little, you know, setup there. How do you start adding value? Because I'm also thinking about it from a business that doesn't do a lot of marketing, which most of our shops probably are more reliant on inbound sales and just the natural, you know, SEO of being local. But you jump in, you start wanting to be the knowledge source for the space. What do you do?
At first, we didn't even have like a marketing department. So it was really the only marketing that we really did was paid advertising on Google. I think we were spending maybe like $500 a month, maybe $1,000 a month just to, you know, get leads coming in. Kind of like what you were saying, just mm-hmm. inbound sales, right? Like, you know, get leads and route them to sales. People talk to them and try to close those deals. We didn't have a lot of kind of, you know, outbound and outwards content. And, we started by just, again, like I said, just listening to our customers, looking at what are the common questions that are being asked. And I think at one point we gathered the entire company. This was when we only had like maybe like 20 people. So it was okay. It was easier to do that. So we gathered the entire company and said, okay, like everyone is responsible for creating content. It's not just content team or not just marketing team. Like, sales get questions all the time. You guys are having hundreds of phone calls with customers all day long. I'm sure there's a ton of questions, right? Service, you're getting questions all the time from customers. How do I do this? How do I do that? I was like, everyone needs to be kind of involved in content creation. And I think that just gave a huge spurt of just this entire, I guess, engine of people just listening in more closely to what customers are asking, whether it's from service, whether it's from sales, and all of that being funneled to kind of our content engine and marketing, kind of like cleaning it up, making videos about it, writing blogs about it, and being able to expand on those topics further. And then in turn, sales gets like an assist in their sales by these articles or by these videos that end up closing deals. And they feel more motivated that, like, oh, wow, like, yeah, the question that I gave about, like, what's the difference between your two machines? Actually, like, I sent that article or sent that video to a customer and that helped. And that helped me close that deal or made that customer more comfortable in answering their question. And they get more confident in being able to contribute. So it's kind of like it fed itself when people felt that they were being helped in their job and make their lives easier in their job by contributing to that content engine. So that's really how we kind of really kickstarted a lot of the content creation, just by essentially crowdsourcing a lot of the content that was that customers wanted to see. And it kind of stemmed from all the interactions that our team had with customers on a daily basis.
Henry, how big is your marketing department?
Right now, it's probably about 20 people just in marketing.
And essentially what you're saying is marketing is teeing up opportunities for sales, right? Like, they're they're at the top of the funnel. They're also educating for support and success, right? And I guess, like, what was the tipping point? Was there an aha moment when you're like, wait a second, like, this is actually organically working? Like, if we were to look at your marketing team 5 years ago to today, how much different, or were you like, I'm going to front load marketing heavy, or was it organic? Tell me about the growth of that, because, like, in our business right now, we're slowly adding more marketing people, and then I'm starting to see, like, the value add. And I'm like, man, I wish I did this earlier. I wish I did this earlier. How long ago was it when you really, like, stepped on it?
I would say probably like 20, thinking back, probably around like 2018, 2019 was when we really kind of like doubled and tripled down on marketing. At first, like, my dad wasn't really kind of convinced that this was gonna work, right?
Because don't waste marketing, your money on that,
right? Yeah. Exactly, right. Because marketing is harder to measure. Like, sales is easy to measure. It's like, okay, I hired a salesperson. This is the number of the amount of revenue they're able to bring in. This is the number of deals that they closed. It's very easy to measure kind of like a salesperson's performance, right? Much harder to measure how much a graphic designer or a content writer is contributing to your bottom line. So it was much harder to justify for that. And in the beginning, I remember very clearly having this, pretty heated conversation with my father that was like, you know, hey, he's like, wow, we're like spending X amount of money on advertising. You know, you have like, at that time, I think like four or five people on the marketing team. But it's not like our revenue is like generating, it's not like much higher than before. But this was maybe like, what, 3-4 months into the whole process. And I knew that it's got to be a much longer game, right? Like, you're not going to see a success overnight if you're investing in marketing. You know, if you're putting into ads, you can see like a direct response to your leads, but like that still takes time to translate into sales. And content's just going to, it's much more intangible. So it was a much longer game that we were playing. And I remember this very heated conversation. I was like, I told him, it's like, I don't think we should focus on being so short-sighted and just looking at what's the immediate return on our marketing. I think that's not able to be measured, but we see that our, reach is increasing, right? I don't know. I can't quantify for you how much that's in terms of revenue, but I believe that that's going to only increase further if you increase your education. It was a little bit of a bet, right? But I kind of knew that was kind of a safer bet because Like, I saw everyone else doing it in other industries, so it had to work. Like, why do people do this, you know, spend time making videos and creating content if it didn't work? So it was really this period of time where we had to just push through. And then once we started to see, oh, wow, instead of selling like 20 machines a month, we were selling like 30, we were selling like 40, we were selling 50. And then we were consistently at that point. We're like, oh, wow, okay, something is clicking. Either, you know, our advertising coupled by kind of just our organic reach, people seeing our content, our YouTube channel was growing. I mean, we started out with like 900 subs when I first joined. And then so it's just like growing it just organically from that, which just saw the compounding effect of content and organic reach and just, you know, general education of the market. And after that, we're just like, yeah, we got to go all in. We got to hire more developers, more graphic designers, more marketers, content writers. I mean, we have like 4 people on the video team just now creating all these like demo videos and content, you know. So we really doubled down on just making sure that we had the right team in place, because now we realize, yeah, there's a lot more to do. We kind of went with a pilot, and then there's a lot more to do that we can expand to, that we want to, you know, do a lot more, a lot faster. So we had to expand the team that way.
What was the conclusion from the argument? Just like, give me 12 months. And
no, it was just like, look, I think I told him at one point, I was like, look, if you want to shut it down, like you can, you know, there's nothing much that I can do, but if you want to shut it down and, you know, let go of the entire marketing team, like feel free to do that. But I don't think that's the right move. I was like, you're looking at the numbers from maybe like 1 or 2 months of just like stagnation from the, you know, maybe 6 months that we were into this project, right? Like that's very, very short-sighted in terms of the time frame. I didn't tell him like, oh, give me 6 months or give me 12 months. Because to be honest, I didn't know how long it was going to take to get to that point. So I was like, look, it's got to take time. I don't know how long it's going to take, but you got to believe in the process. But hey, if you want to just scrap everything and because you feel like it's not working, do that as well. And I think like maybe like years later, he ended up telling me, it's like, yeah, it's like if you weren't family and someone else was having that conversation with me, I probably would have just like scrapped everything and then just like start over. But because I was like, you know, I wanted to give you a chance to try. And then I was like, it ended up being the best decision we've ever made. Right.
So yeah, I think it's interesting. So like in our industry, I'll just name a few, like Ryan Moore from Ryanet. Right. Like,
yeah.
Making educational videos early on and teaching people and then mm-hmm. growing with them as customers, that is so sticky that it's there forever, right? And they can keep capitalizing on it. And then you see competitors trying to backtrack and be like, we'll do a little bit of that and see if it works. It's a very long game. Another one, Bruce, is like Supacolor. And when Rum came to the first Print Hustlers with just samples, and it was very early on, right? And now it's a content-making educational machine that just so happens. And to Printavo's credit, Bruce, like early days, you would just, you know, be like, hey, I need you to write a blog. Can you write a blog? Can you write a blog a week?
Right? Yeah.
You put a freelancer on me to bug me. Henry Steven would
help write it. Cause I'm not in a shop. Like, you know, I was in there for a year and then Steven's like growing and kind of documenting his journey. So
yeah. But if you think about it, like it's hard for a company then to backtrack. Like the competitors, they like, it's like them, you're running a marathon that you started right. five years ago,
if it's not in the strategy and you're just like, it's not part of something that you're doing and care about long-term, then it's just, you can't like just dip your toe in for,
there's no short-term fix to it whatsoever.
Yeah, no. How do you deal with that, Steve? I mean, you kind of jumped into, you know, family owned and like, I'm sure you had new ideas that were not, like, hey, we need to do this. Like, how do you work through that? And I know a lot of the shops we work with too are in the same boat.
I ask for forgiveness, not permission. You know, like I think when I talk to my business partner, who's like close enough to be my father, you know, I actually had 2 business partners at the time. One that encouraged me, but didn't understand what was going on. The other that was kind of pessimistic about it all. And I just kind of trudged ahead. I was very much like, hey, this is the new way of thinking. This is the new way of doing it, you know, and we had a lot of hard conversations, like, why do you need to take them out to dinner once a week? Or why do you need to plan retreats? And why do you need to do all these things? And it's like, no. Like, if we're going to do this right, you know, it has to be special. It has to be unique. And now it's a part of our identity. and why people want to work for us and grow there. So like, Bruce, to your question, definitely tough conversations. I think if you are in a family business or you have the younger owner and the older owner or the younger person, you have to let the new ideas like fly. You can't keep curbing them. To your point, Henry, like your dad just wasn't part of how he ran a business and he didn't understand, but it's not any fault to his own. He just, that's not what he knew what to do.
Right.
And so I think to these smaller shops that have these people, they have to let them fly and let them do that. Like we have interns right now making TikToks for us and I'm sitting there like laughing at them. I'm like, I could never make these if my life depended on them, and they're going viral. And I'm just like, great job. Like you do your TikToks, you do your thing. Like we could never, Bruce and I tried to make a couple
Steven's
ones.
The old guy now.
I'm the old TikTok. Guy now. Right. But like those generational gaps are going to exist and you have to be conscious about them. And, you know, you have to try new things out. Cause let's just say this, like 3 years ago, TikTok didn't exist.
Yeah.
And now it's like, if you're not on TikTok, you're missing out or whatever. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Bruce, what's that strategy like at Printavo? I know you're content crazy. Is everyone else bought into it too? Or do they just think you're the crazy person?
No, I think it didn't make sense for sure for the first probably year or so. And it didn't make sense to me as well as like, is this really worth the time? But my thought was the same as yours, Henry, was that these other space, like I'm on YouTube, I'm watching all these other things, like I'm trying to pick up on these people. And so how do we become the knowledge source for the space? But it was baked into like what I believed long-term. It just, it didn't show an ROI probably for a good year, probably more so 2 years. Of like then the sales people mentioning it again, like, oh, don't stop doing those. And I think what's hard though is how do you keep doing it long term? So, you know, you can get kind of burnt out doing the same videos or like, what do I talk about? Or, you know, and maybe that is like with building the team, like you did, of just adding people, letting them source ideas, letting the whole team source ideas, putting them in a doc, you know, pulling it off your shoulders. Cause especially as a business grows, you just get so much busier and you're like, geez,
for sure.
Is this video is the most important thing I should be doing or what, you know?
No, yeah, for sure. I find that, I experienced that right now. Like, you know, they have to set aside time on my schedule for me to shoot the videos. And sometimes I'm like, yeah, I'm burnt out. Sometimes I'm like, oh man, I got like 100 other things to take care of that like seems more, a lot more urgent. It's like, mm-hmm. It's spending like an hour and a half shooting a video. Like, you know, so I sometimes keep on pushing it off. It's like, oh, let's do it tomorrow. But at the end of the day, I realize it's like, yeah, we gotta get this done. Right. And so, sometimes, you know, when you're the CEO or, you know, when you're at a higher level in the organization, you kind of have to just be the face of the company. Like that's a lot of where you spend your time, being the face of recruiting, of retaining talent, and then being the face of the company to your customers. Right. But yeah, you're right. A lot of the ideas are generated behind the scenes of like, you know, people looking, scouring through Facebook groups or, you know, comments to see what questions people ask. And we just try to make that process easier because, you know, there's a lot of knowledge that we can all share in our businesses. I think sometimes it's just a little hard. It's like, okay, what do people want to hear about? So if we can make that process easy, you can just ramble on for like 30 minutes talking about a topic and it will, you know, sound good to the customer. Right. So as long as it's something that they're interested in and we can source that topic, I think it makes the rest, like the shooting part is easy. I think the thinking about, you know, what to shoot, how to shoot it, that's the difficult part.
Great. Gary V said, think about documenting the process, not
content creation. Yeah.
Right. And it becomes easier. It's like, oh, yeah. I had this problem. Okay. Document. Like I'm sure other small businesses that would be my customer have the exact same problem of hiring or this problem or whatever.
I have a question. Can I switch gears for a sec? I'm just kind of looking. And the reason I ask this is like when we buy an embroidery machine, we're good for a while, right? Like is the majority of your revenue on existing customers or is it new customers? Like, cause once you're
service maybe, look,
or is it, cause I'm noticing like y'all sell vinyl cutters, sewing machines, embroidery accessories, also software is in there. How much of your revenue is just like embroidery machines? I'm just curious for shops listening.
I mean, still a large majority of our revenue comes from that, because that's our bread and butter. We've only recently, probably in the last 24 months, have expanded into like other product lines in an aggressive way. So embroidery definitely still plays a huge part in that. I would say that a big portion is still coming from new business, right? So new clients. But over the last several years, because we've been growing at such a fast clip, we've planted a lot of seeds, so to speak, in the marketplace. And so now, in the recent years, in the last probably 12 to 18 months, we've recently started to see a lot more repeat business of people that got into the business from kind of, just starting out. And then now they're expanding their equipment base because they're needing more to fulfill orders, right? To fulfill them faster, or they're expanding into direct-to-garment printing, or vice versa. They were in screen printing, they got into embroidery, and now they're expanding embroidery even further. So I think we've been seeing a lot more repeat business in recent years, and I think that's going to continue to happen. But you're right. I'm also thinking how can we create recurring revenue in the long run, right? Because you're right, when you buy an embroidery machine, you're good for 5, 10, 15 years maybe, right? So you might not be able to get that second sale until much later, either when they're kind of switching out their equipment, or hopefully if they're expanding their equipment base, then you might be able to capture that revenue sooner. But I'm also thinking kind of how to create recurring revenue on a yearly basis, from our ecosystem.
Henry and Steven, we got the two embroidery masters. Can I call you an embroidery master, Steven?
Me? Absolutely not.
what are some things?
I mean, we embroider, but I am not. I can barely hoop, and I can cut backing. That's about it.
Pass me the scissors. What are some things for embroidery businesses? I've heard this feedback before that we don't cover enough for majority embroidery businesses. So tips that those types of shops can do to help improve. Obviously there's the kind of professionalization of the business, but any best practices, Henry, that you see, any tips there, any things that will help save them time?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess we can break it down into the production process versus your sales and marketing process. I think the production process, and I think a lot of shops, I mean, they've got their production processes pretty worked out. Yeah. So probably on the production side, you want to make sure that your operations is as efficient as possible, right? You want to make sure your operators are trained properly. You want to make sure that you have almost a production line going even if you're, screen printing, you got your dryers ready, or if you're embroidering, you got people that are able to clean up the embroidery, just kind of have a nice flow. Make sure your operators are trained on being able to handle multiple machines, so that increases their capacity of being able to operate those machines at the same time. All of that is really important on the operational side. And then on the sales side, I think on just your sales operations, I think that's where a lot of maybe smaller shops are a little bit weaker at, right? Because they're, and it's natural when you're getting into the business, you're focusing on production. It's like, I got into it as a one-man show, and I'm producing all these pieces of apparel and fulfilling these orders. That's your natural focus. You're not really focused on, hey, sales process and marketing process, follow-ups, etc., right? And I think you, Bruce, you talked about this a lot. The follow-ups are super important in any sales process, whether regardless of any industry that you're in. And so people are not naturally going to transact with you on the first interaction, just like you wouldn't ask someone to get married on the first date, right? Like, that's just not a natural course of human interaction. So the follow-ups is super important. And I think probably a lot of shops are missing out on potential revenue, leaving money on the table by simply not following up. It's like, if I gave you a quote and you didn't respond, then I just move on to the next quote that some other guy asked me. But that follow-up, you might be able to capture, I don't know, 20, 30, 40% of those processes, back into revenue. And that can, dramatically boost your business without having to acquire new customers, right? Like, I think a big part of what we're doing in sales right now is okay, if marketing just was stagnant today, and we're not increasing a single dollar of marketing spend, and this is what we have to work with, how do we increase sales? That's like the $1 million question we're trying to figure out. It's like, how do you increase sales by 20% 30% if marketing stayed stagnant and we're not increasing marketing spend. And that's the goal to get to, because then, you know, you can, when you have multiple levers in your business that you can pull, you can increase marketing, you can, you know, your sales is doing better, your processes are better, then you're like 4xing, 5xing your business instead of just, you know, 1x or 2x, right? So that's the kind of problem we're trying to figure out. And I think it's a very interesting thing to tackle.
I'm pulling up real quick. I just want to shout out Deco Summit. Pulling up the dates, October 7th and 9th is Racoma's apparel education experience with a heavy embroidery focus. I went to the last one, which was really cool. They've got a bunch of machines, ton of education, whether you're just getting into it or you're looking to add machines. Definitely check it out. Deco Summit, DECOSummit.com. Henry Ma, thank you. This has been
thank you, Bruce. And Bruce, you're going to be there as a speaker. So
I am. I am going to be there. So again, coming out. Is it in Miami or
yeah,
Florida?
It's right by the airport.
Oh, okay, sweet. So Miami, if you want a fun trip to Miami too, double up.
Always.
Thanks, guys, for listening to the Printava podcast. Bruce from Printava, Steve Farrick, Henry Ma from Racoma. We'll see you in the next episode.